Radio Riva, Brighton Festival 2018. Now, all of the news, reviews, and what not to miss at Brighton Festival 2018 with Melita Dennett and Rebecca Sandals on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, the only station on air with a dedicated Brighton Festival hour.
You're listening to Radio Reverb 97.2 FM on DAB and online at radioreverb.com. I'm Melita Dennett. This is Wednesday's Brighton Festival special. We're here daily during the festival, 5 to 6pm, repeated 10pm and 9am the next day.
And I'm Rebecca Sandals, and for the next 3 days we'll be looking behind the scenes at the Brighton Festival, meeting some of the performers, creators and people who make it happen. Today we're hearing about the perils of talking in your sleep and sleepwalking.
We'll be discovering new styles of tango music for the 21st century.
Finding out how a children's show challenges ideas of disability.
And exploring some of our deepest fears in words and music.
It's along with reviews and previews in the next hour here on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM.
We are jammy packed with festival goodness. We have a studio filled to the brim. The String Quartet's Guide to Sex and Anxiety is the intriguing title of a show opening tonight at the Theatre Royal. It's a live string quartet playing along to readings which explore some of the more discomforting aspects of human existence. One of the performers is actor Kathy Tyson, but let's hear first a short extract of her reading from The Anatomy of Melancholy by Robert Burton.
Methinks I hear, methinks I see, sweet music, wondrous melody. Towns, palaces, and cities fine. Here now, then there. The world is mine. Rare beauties, gallant ladies shine. Whate'er is lovely, or divine, all other joys to this are folly. None so sweet as melancholy. Methinks I hear, methinks I see ghosts, goblins, fiends. My fantasy presents a thousand ugly shapes. Headless bears, vile men, and apes. Doleful outcries and fearful sights. My sad and dismal soul affrights. All my griefs to this are jolly. None so damned as melancholy.
Well, Kathy Tyson joins us now. That extract there from The Anatomy of Melancholy by Robert Burton sends a shiver down the spine when you hear it. I mean, not only in the way you read it, but the musical backing and the thoughtfulness of the text. Does that kind of, that piece kind of set the scene for the show of what to expect?
Well, yes, because there's dark and light, isn't there? That doesn't happen. That piece isn't at the beginning of the piece. It is somewhere embedded within the show. But yes, you know, one minute we're happy and then the next, you know, life can deal us difficult blows going between the two, you know, moods, really.
So this is a fascinating idea to pair texts and musical backings from the Heath Quartet. How was it developed?
Well, Calixto's worked with the Heath Quartet before.
This is the director.
Bieto, Calixto Bieto. And he has known these writers for many years, so he gathered together pieces of writing that reflected the themes of the piece and had worked with the quartet that, you know, a couple of years ago or a few years ago. And merged them together with the two pieces of music that we're focusing on, which is Ligeti's, a piece by Ligeti, and a Beethoven quartet.
Nice, nice.
And it's not just the quartet of musicians, it's a quartet of actors on the stage playing different anxieties.
Yes.
How does that work?
It's direct address, so there's somebody suffering with OCD and then depression and then existential angst and then somebody with PTSD. And we're just, it's direct address to the audience, and sometimes we, you know, relate to each other, but other times we don't. And then the music, the plays, when we stop talking. So Calixto from the top of rehearsal said, I don't want music on. Well, he said, didn't say I don't want. He was very open. He put it to us. He said, what do you think? I don't think that's a good idea to have music underscoring the words so they're separate.
So was there a degree of improvisation in the show?
No, he doesn't like improvisation.
Oh, same.
When I went for the audition, I said, oh, will we be improvising? He said, no, I absolutely detest improvisation. But what we do is we create every night. The actors do something different. So from that point of view, it is like improvisation in a way, because we're doing something different.
What's the difference between doing something different and improvisation?
I think there isn't.
You're
I
just
think
cheekily getting something past the director.
The thing is that we are, the structure is the same, but there are small, subtle details that are different. Mm-hmm. So it's not radically different every night. But there's, you know, so I don't think there is a difference between improvisation and that. We just don't call it.
In case he gets upset.
I just remember it's not termed that. But maybe there is a difference as well.
Don't know.
But this was scripted. We came to the rehearsal with a script. Mm-hmm. So a lot of improvised stuff doesn't start out as a script. But we did have a rough script.
Now, we're improvising a bit in the studio now because we're expecting you to join us on your own. But what a treat. You brought the Heath Quartet with you.
That's
so we have with us Chris Murray, Ollie Heath, Sarah Wolstenholme and Gary Pomeroy.
Hi.
Thanks for coming along.
And all squeezed into the magnificent setting of the Reverb Studio. And you're going to give us some music. Well, are we ready to take it away?
Let's hear. Thank you.
Wowza.
Thank you so much.
That's the Heath Quartet live on Radio Reverb in our Bijou studio. It's not size that counts, it's what you do with it. So thank you very much for joining us there and playing Beethoven Opus 95.
That's correct.
Lovely. I would imagine that there's going to be quite a lot of emotion going on during this show from the audience.
Yeah, especially as we're looking at them. And I just, especially as we are directly looking at them. But I was just thinking whilst I was listening to them play, you know, how the piece is growing every day as well. You know, because I suppose you don't want to be, I don't want to be formulaic about grief, which is what my character's going through. Mm. And I still feel as if I'm, you know, really building on what we've done in the past. And I think the others are as well. And I was thinking about anger and how there's pieces, there's words in the piece, you know, how, you know, life is so is constructed in such a merciless fashion that even when we plan, what the hell is the point of it? And things like that really help me get into character when I think about what's the, you know, I think my character is what is the point? Something happens. What's the point of doing this? Which can obviously cover a depression, you know, if you think, what's the point? You know, I was planning, had all this, I had a beautiful life, and then everything. What's the, and that really helped. You know, I have to, like the musicians, they are some of the most hardworking people I've ever worked with. Mm. I have to practice to get into this piece because I feel a fraud if I under emote.
Wow.
And I watch them practice. We as actors practice in different ways, but emotionally practice as well.
So has it taken you a bit outside your own comfort zones then? It sounds
like
it has.
I hope so. I want that to happen, but unfortunately, I don't think it has. Sometimes I like to push myself, but sometimes I don't reach the place where I want to get. But it's kind of all in the lap of the gods on the night, isn't it? Because if you force something, that can be the worst thing to do as well. But has it taken me out of my comfort zone? Yeah, because it's distressing, you know. But I just think also if people are talking about grief, difficult problems, that's also relieving as well. To give space to that in our Facebooked kind of everything's all talking about the positive world. To give space to people who are in pain and put that centre stage. I need to get out of my comfort zone even more. Yeah.
Now, there's been a lot of focus there in what you're talking about on the anxiety and the mental health issues. Now, clearly this piece was sold as a guide to sex as well.
The Heath Quartet's guide to sex.
Right, so
and anxiety.
Guys, are you doing the sex guide then?
Well,
they're keeping very quiet now.
that word, sex, sorry, are you going to ask?
No,
guys? There's writing that people are talking about, which I think, you know, which I can identify with, you know, anxiety around sex that we all have to some degree. That's quite liberating to hear that. And uncomfortable, not just liberating, but uncomfortable to hear.
Especially for British people. We're so horribly reserved, aren't we? And don't talk about things.
So it's, you know, it's good to have that on our stages. And Calixto was really adamant that we weren't banal in talking about the sex, because that word can bring up, you know, sex sells as well, doesn't it? So he was particular about, I didn't want to be banal. It's just very truthful, I think.
He sounds like a real character of Calixto Beato. I mean, I was looking up some of the things he's done. He's upset the staid opera world, which can be terribly stuffy. He was staging traditional pieces in unconventional ways. Did things like having characters sitting on the toilet. And he's name-checked film directors like Buñuel, Kurosawa, Fellini as influences. They're all people who take chances and don't follow convention. I mean, he sounds like quite a geezer. Man after my own heart, I think, with those kind of tastes.
And yet he is, but also the simple risks as well. I think the way he works, I remember he told me to, he takes chances, but when he's doing them, he's not gung-ho about it. It just is, it's I think it's part of his character. It's automatic now. And I think he appreciates his imagination. I don't think he takes that for granted, that, you know, he's going to wake up with ideas all the time. Who does? You know, I think he has the same difficulties others have creatively. But he mentioned it, like, we're doing some... None of these pieces are written as plays or for actors. Mm-hmm. They're all pieces of writing. They weren't specifically written for the stage. So that's a risk in itself. But I think one thing about, you know, creators like Calixto is that they make me think of the possibilities of what I can do. So it's good being around people like that, because it opens up my world to, actually, I can do this, I can do that. We need people like him.
Another question back to the music, because for a lot of people dealing with mental health issues, dealing with grief, music is something people turn to. So do you think the music in this piece is a sort of helpful and make people feel better and happier?
I do. But I also, you've got to hear from the musicians themselves. I feel very bad about just me speaking. Ollie, anybody?
I don't think we can squeeze it. I'm looking at the clock as well. I'm
aware. How long have we got on the clock?
How long have we got? Well, minus 39 seconds,
Ollie,
actually.
Can say something. Ollie, they're here. They're all here. Tell us.
I can speak in minus 39 seconds. well, I think it's really interesting. It's kind of divided into two halves. There's Ligeti's second string quartet, which is a very kind of angst-causing work, very nervous, very tense, quite brutal in times, and then we play Beethoven, a bit of which we just heard, and it feels like there's a kind of cathartic quality to the music when the Beethoven starts, that certainly isn't there with Ligeti. Mm-hmm. So I think it kind of serves both purposes, really, to really add to the
emotion, drama, conflict,
and a hint of kind of resolution at the end.
I mean, it does sound absolutely amazing, and I'm coming to see it tomorrow. Kathy, it sounds like the kind of show then that is going to leave people with conversations,
yes,
as they leave the auditorium, you know, really putting people deep into thought and expanding
it's
those conversations.
It's a listening show as well. Mm. You know, there are a couple of spectacular things that happen set-wise, but it demands a lot of their concentration. And people have talked about things afterwards, you know, the form, because he's playing with form. Well, I say playing with form. You know, sometimes somebody's speaking and another person will be moving. So, you know, it demands concentration wise. People have said to me it was difficult at times because somebody, you know, where to put the focus.
Yeah.
But the audience has their own, can direct themselves as to where they want to look.
I think it's good to challenge an audience. So the String Quartet's Guide to Sex and Anxiety opens tonight at the Theatre Royal. So tonight and tomorrow, Thursday, both at 7:30. Do grab your tickets, because I think this is going to be the talk of the festival. I have to say, it's Cathy Tyson. Thank you so much for joining us, and the Heath Quartet in our Bijou Radio Reverb studio.
Thank you for having us.
Cheers. It's been a great pleasure. I look forward to seeing it tomorrow.
Oh, thank you for coming as well.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Yeah, thank you for joining us.
Don't come.
Well, they will after they've heard this.
Interviewed and stuff, you know. Thanks for speaking. I just thought, God, you know.
Well, we could have kept going with you guys for practically the whole length of your show tonight at Brighton Festival, but we have a packed programme.
And you've got a show to run off to.
Where are we going to now? Are we going to go to some music?
No. We're going to go to Ezra Furman playing Saturday Night at the Dome. This is Ezra Furman and Love You Bad. Wowee. Ezra Furman, Love You So Bad, playing Saturday at the Dome. So the last gig of the Brighton Festival, apart from Belshazzar's Feast coming on Sunday. But I think that's the last big pop music gig. Oh, live radio. Well, I love live radio.
Have you checked out the back? Have they all gone? There's Chris, Ollie, Sarah and Gary, the Heath Quartet, who joined us. And all their stands and, yeah.
And Cathy Tyson. We genuinely didn't expect the Heath Quartet to pitch up as well. We thought we're just going to have Cathy and just like a nice little chat with her about this rather intriguing show. And then the Heath Quartet pitched up as well. So it was great.
Festival radio show. It's special.
It is special.
The Brighton Festival 2018. Radio Reverb. The only station on air with a dedicated Brighton Festival hour.
Now, never let it be said that Brighton Festival 2018 isn't reaching out to all ages of audience. This weekend sees a show targeted at the under ones.
Yes, none walking babies. So if you have a little one gurgling alongside you right now, slurping on a dummy, then this show truly is for you. Sniggle and Friends is an invitation to join an inquisitive snail and friends in a cosy home under a leaf canopy as they dance, sing and play music. I got onto Skype to find out more about the piece.
I am Caroline Brodich and I am one of the co-creators of Sniggle and Friends. So I made this piece last year with Laura Hook, who has done the design for the show, and I also play Sniggle.
This isn't Sniggle's first outing, is it? What's Sniggle's history?
Sniggle has a kind of partner piece, which is called The Adventures of Sniggle, which is also co-created with Laura Hook. Adventures is about my motorised chair becoming my giant snail shell, and it was a piece that we made for festivals. So it's a promenade piece, and it's aimed at kind of 3 to 8-year-olds. But Sniggle and Friends is for our very youngest audience, so it's aimed at under ones, and we have been performing this piece since May last year, and we took it to the Fringe Festival in Edinburgh.
I spoke to someone who had a piece called Apples earlier in the festival, but that was aimed at children over the age of 18 months, so already quite small. And yeah, then I was thinking, how does that work with keeping their attention? So how does it work with the babies? I mean, sort of 3 months, 4, 5 months
yeah,
old?
So they're actually really amazing. And someone said to me the other day who has children, it's a bit like a live version of CBeebies. And I was like, okay. But kids stay really engaged with it. It's amazing. And it's a really interactive piece. So everything happens at baby level. All the performers perform at a low level. No performers ever stand up, primarily because I can't, so I just made it a rule for everybody. But also it becomes a not scary thing for babies because there's no grown-ups kind of towering over them at any point. It involves various things coming towards them, so things like bubbles and scarves, and it has live music. It's kind of constantly moving, but in a very gentle way, and it happens in this incredible environment that Laura's created, which makes us feel like we're in the undergrowth and we've shrunk really little.
And so is it quite a sensory experience?
So it's really colourful. It never gets dark, so there's always lights on in various forms around them. So it's really tactile, and I make sound the whole time. So this is the other important thing, is that I make sound the whole time, but I never speak English. So I'm constantly speaking Sniggle, which is very much like a baby language is before they acquire language. So they're not having to work to understand text, as it were, and it's also very responsive to the audience. So if babies make sound, we make sound back to them, which they seem to enjoy.
So how do you say hello in Sniggle?
So it just, that happens the whole time.
Well, that's put a big grin to my face, so I can imagine it does. Similar to small people.
Every performance is a relaxed performance, so there is no sense of kids can't make noise and parents, everybody sits. So all the audience are invited to sit on mats and cushions on the floor, so they're all comfortable as well. People are completely encouraged to have that as their space, so if they need to feed, to change their babies or to do whatever they need to be comfortable in the space, it's all allowed.
So basically you don't have to have your child high on Calpol before you come along, is what you're
saying? Definitely not, definitely not.
Now, the show itself is a good bite size for the age group. It was about 25 minutes or so, is it, with playtime?
Yeah, it's about half an hour of performance and then about, 10 minutes of playtime where they get to come onto the set and play with us. That generally involves quite a lot of climbing on us, and I have quite a lot of babies that love to suck my nose, which is quite fun. And often parents are really reluctant to leave the space just because it's comfortable and welcoming, and they've had a nice time.
That's Caroline Bowditch. They're talking about Sniggle and Friends at the Dome Founders Room Friday through Sunday. And we'll hear more from Caroline later on in the programme.
And still to come, we're going to be talking about the perils of sleepwalking and sleep talking. A Brighton Festival show called Elephant and Castle, which we went to see last night. Very funny show with its darker side to it. Before that, let's have a dark track. This is Malcolm Middleton, We're All Gonna Die. Malcolm Middleton, We're All Going to Die. You can see him with Ian Shaw tomorrow, Thursday, at St George's Church in the Brighton Festival. You're listening to the Brighton Festival special show with Melita Dennett and Rebecca Sandals. And a show all about the perils of talking in your sleep and sleepwalking is on at the Brighthelm Centre. Elephant and Castle is a show with it's got lots of laughs. It's funny. It's got poignant songs. And it's also got a darker side to it. It's been put together by Tom Adams and Lillian Henley, based on their real life marriage and Tom's nocturnal ramblings. And they both join us now. Thanks for coming on Radio Reverb.
Hello, nice to be here.
You can assure me you're actually wide awake, aren't you, Tom?
Yeah, I'm awake now. Yeah, I walked here completely conscious.
Good. So you've been sleepwalking and sleep talking all your life. Tell us about your condition.
Yeah, I have been. It's kind of, I've got slow wave sleep parasomnia, and that is the time of our sleep, slow wave. They call it slow wave because it's when our brainwave activity is very slowed down and when we're sleeping. So I tend to do it every night at 1 a.m. most nights. I'm getting my deepest sleep. And it's basically kind of when I first met Lily about 10 years ago, she told me that I slept talked quite a lot. And then on and on with our relationship, you know, over the years, she's told me all the things I've done, and I got this app, really good app for my iPhone. You can put it by your bed and it picks up everything that you speak about, and you talk in your sleep completely unconscious. And I think that's why I wanted to make the show, because I felt like it was a moment of complete and utter, I've got no idea what I'm doing or what I'm saying. So there's kind of that real, you know, it's kind of a, what is that?
It's a train crash of thought, really,
yeah,
isn't
exactly,
it?
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
Something's just sprung to mind. Have you got an Alexa in your house? Because I would dread to think what could happen overnight.
I probably don't want to get one.
You could order
one, yeah.
Or any sort
of
thing.
I know, order loads of... Well,
cats.
I did say in my sleep once, can I have a potato? And so I'd probably get up, you know, one potato through the post.
Well, yeah. Anyway,
that's a good idea. We should add that into the show.
So the show does feature recordings of your ramblings. You're very sweary in your sleep. Are you sweary in real life?
Not that much. No, I'm not really that sweary, you know, as much as the next person, really. But
good, because it's live radio and you're not allowed to
swear.
Yeah,
exactly. I wouldn't know. I wouldn't dream of it. But in my sleep, I'm quite... either scared, I'm sweary, aggressive, sometimes towards Lily, sometimes towards an invisible person. I sat up in bed and shouted, no, 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 go away, you know, and swearing loads. So, and Lily was quite scared by this, I reckon Lil was. So it's a funny condition. I'm on the scale of it, I'm not as bad as some people. We interviewed some people who really suffer from night terrors, mm-hmm. and they are really affecting their sleep, and we, you know, they were kind of, yeah, had to go to a special sleep hospital and be watched and analysed with the whole brain things on their head. So it is a fascinating subject, I think, and really young science, sleep, and there's so much poetry to it as well, and what we do at night when we're unconscious.
Sure. Yeah. And Lillian, I was wondering then what impact it had on you, because what happened when you first realised that Tom was a sleep talker and a sleepwalker? You had a whirlwind courtship, so you didn't know each other kind of all that well, I guess.
No, that's true. I think from the first time that we actually shared a bed, it happened and it was quite a violent utterance, and it was, he did sit up in the bed and was quite aggressive, and it did surprise me and it did shock me to the point where I thought, oh, this is quite dark, who is this person, because in the daytime he's really lovely. And so we spoke about it, and it became something that I don't think Tom was entirely aware of, how adventurous perhaps his sleep utterances are. And then of course the sleepwalking started to increase. I'm not entirely sure why, but we did do some research about potentially if he's in a new environment, and we realised it happens a lot when we stay in other places. So obviously we're in Brighton in a new place.
Uh-oh.
All right, 3 a.m. along the seafront. If you see a man not wearing very much wandering around, it could well be Tom Adams.
Shouting and demanding potatoes and kittens and swearing at you, yeah.
But luckily... it is in our case, it is quite minor, but I think the thing that is the slightly more worrying side is whether it will increase with age, or I don't think the scientists necessarily know what it is exactly, but if you have a different kind of parasomnia that actually is when you act out your dreams, so that's in REM sleep, that's actually when it is more worrying. It can we did some research and we were told by the sleep doctor, Dr. Ian Smith, that there is potentially a link with Parkinson's. So obviously that's quite a worrying thing.
Well, I was going to say we were laughing about you know potentially waking in the night and wandering around Brighton. But you know, there's a serious side to this, and there's a serious side to the show. And we both sort of laughed and heard the words of the sleep doctor, I think, in the show.
Yeah.
So how frightening is it? I mean, and how strange is it to make people laugh about your condition? Is that helpful to you?
Yeah, I love making people laugh and try and do it any way I can, really. So this seems to be the best, kind of the newest way I can do it, really. I really enjoy hearing other people's sleep talking stories and sleep walking stories. And I think it is it's a funny thing. It's I think it's because it's so... We don't know what it is, really. We kind of, our natural response is maybe to laugh at it. And it is this, like you said, it is a kind of an avalanche of thoughts. It's a kind of, I heard a description, it's like hot off the griddle. It's this kind of really, it's so fresh and there's no filter whatsoever. And we're, you know, constantly filtering all our thoughts. This is the one time we're not filtering our thoughts or our actions. But like with sleepwalking, I've woken up in the shower, things like that, or I've chucked my duvet out of the window, and so I'm just doing basic things that I would do during the day, or I don't know what I was doing when I chucked my duvet out the window, but that's all really strange, but yeah.
But it is a really good point, because I think that's one of the things why we wanted to explore the theme of sleepwalking in the show, because I think for us, we're aware that it's something that is quite contained, and it hasn't become... I think when we inquired about it, well, is Tom a danger to himself?
Mm.
And I think there's times when I think... well, he did walk into a door, so yes, in that scenario, yes, he was a danger to himself. But luckily, he did it in a way that, of course, if it was in another scenario and he... there's an element of danger that I think is the unknown, and we're not quite sure what he is capable of. But in our history of being together, it's been fairly minor, so I feel like it's not an extreme case, although, yes, there's always that not knowing what might happen. And we did in our research, we found scenarios of people who really, really do damage themselves and falling down the stairs, and which is a horrendous thing to find yourself, because you can really damage yourself. But, you know, so I think we wanted to discover it and explore it and realise that this is a really, really delicate subject, that actually, once you get past the sort of funny kind of side of it and you actually begin to kind of unpick it and realise that this is something that isn't able to be controlled because you're not aware of what's happening. So I think that's the thing that I think we find quite worrying to other people that do suffer from it, as well as at the moment for us personally, it's controllable to extent where we feel like we're in a place where we... I think
like you know what's going to happen.
Yeah. Although when we did move, we did put our bedroom from a ground floor flat to three flights of stairs, and we thought, oh, this might be interesting. But for us, it's fairly predictable. And
it's inspirational for a musical. I think we should hear...
Well, yeah. So you're both musicians, and you've made the show very music-led. So I think we ought to hear then one of your tracks. This is a Somnambulist. That's Somnambulist, taken from the show Elephant and Castle. We're talking to Tom Adams and Lillian Henley. Tom, one of my favourite songs in the show was one where you got into a very awkward situation with a work colleague when you were sharing a hotel room. Tell us a bit about that.
So it was... we'd only just met, really. We started this job. You tour around quite a lot and you stay in hotel rooms with different colleagues. And so this is the first night we'd shared a room together. And that first night... I do sleep naked generally.
Thankfully, you're not naked in the show.
No, I'm not naked now.
Know that.
Exactly.
No,
yeah.
You're not now.
Exactly. Yeah. Or that. You know. And all of that. You know. It's Brighton, but go. You know. Come on. So I was sleeping naked. Stupidly, I don't know why, because I was sharing a room, but we were kind of, you know, we're actors together. We were getting on. And then that night, I slept walked around the room, and completely unconscious, I got into his bed. And I straddled him completely naked.
Oh, dear.
I know. And I kind of got back into bed. And then I woke up the next day and I felt really strange. And I felt like I'd done... Something had happened. You know that feeling of like, what had I... Something I've done. And I got like a vague, tiny memory because I probably woke up just a bit as I was, you know, straddling him at that point. I know.
Naked,
yes. As you would. There.
Oh,
I know.
Cringe.
I know. Yeah. And then he. So that happened. And then I kind of. We didn't speak about it the next morning at all. We're getting on with rehearsals. And then the next day I did something. I straddled him again.
God.
Completely naked. And then. I think that morning I did say, have I done something? Am I doing something? And the night, I feel like it's either a really weird dream or I am actually doing this, but it feels real. And he went, no, you did. Yeah, you have been getting into bed with me. he's very kind of open and like, oh, great.
Just as well.
I know.
Could ruin a beautiful friendship.
Yeah, totally.
Or start another one.
I know. It was great, yeah. And he, so that was kind of, but all that week I did, that was the first two nights I straddled him. Then the rest of the week I was doing odd things, trying to climb out the window. And it was an odd room, I think. I don't know what was happening. But 6 months later, I was researching the show and I called him up, just asking if can he tell me anything. And he just kind of opened up and sort of went, yeah, it was really weird.
You mean he remembered it?
He remembered it, I know. But he's very kind of cool about it all and all that. But that kind of opens up. It just opens up so many kind of areas, doesn't it, into kind of conduct, you know, with your professionals, things like that. You know, in today's, you know, climate, it's just kind of really fascinating, I think. Kind of, I don't know what I'm doing. People have gotten off for murdering their family members because they were asleep, and that's cases in the past. It's just, there's a rich seam of...
Lillian is chewing her finger at that point.
I keep getting nervous. Wait a second. Oh, no. This is a good cover story.
I'm getting incriminated now on the radio. It's what I've done can be laughed off, you know, but also if you looked at it another way, you'd think, if I did that kind of consciously, you know, what would you say then? You know, We kind of leave that to the audience's imagination, I like to, you know what I mean? Try and let them make up their own minds, not come down in either way. Just try and keep it, you know, keep it fun, entertaining.
Well, that's what I really liked about it, because it's got the comic moments, it's got the cringe-worthy moments, and then it's got those real darker sides, and it takes the audience on a little bit of a roller coaster ride. But it's a reasonably brief show, but it seems like it's a subject that's ripe for further study and myth-busting. I guess you're planning to expand it.
I definitely think so, yeah. We're really interested in the concept of sleep, especially being a married couple, like sort of like how we cope with that together. We're thinking about our next show being a show called Catnap, maybe like all about being a 20-minute sleep is a great way to kind of revive yourself, and we'd write some 20 minutes of music that people can sleep to. That's in the pipeline. But we'd like to explore sleepwalking and sleep talking. Maybe because it's a kind of gig theatre show, lots of, you know, we can maybe slot songs in and adapt them and make them more kind of angry if we want to. There's real scope. It's kind of, yeah, like you can just go boom, slot modular kind of style, slot any kind of songs in, really.
A lot more to go, yeah. So that's Elephant and Castle at the Brightham Centre tonight, 7:30. Last night tonight, Tom Adams and Lillian Henley. And we know now that if we see a headline on the Brighton Argus saying naked man demanding potatoes on the seafront and swearing loudly, we know it's you.
Exactly.
Thanks very much for joining us on Radio Reverb.
Thank you
very much.
Cheers, thank you.
You're listening to Radio Reverb's Festival Special Show with Melita Dennett and Rebecca Sandals on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, DAB and online. Now, more from Caroline Bowditch, the performer and choreographer of Sniggle and Friends. That's a children's show for the under ones at the Dome Founders Room this weekend. Caroline is also a consultant and accessibility and inclusivity, and I asked her earlier how she and Sniggle's co-creator, Laura Hook, went about addressing inclusivity in their work.
Laura and I had done a year of research because we wanted to make this work. So we went to see lots of other work aimed at a young audience and came to the realisation very quickly that very little, if any of it, included any diversity in the body. So it was always standing up, non-disabled, primarily white bodies that were presenting work. And I just thought, I need to do something about that. That's not acceptable.
Well, it's so not the world, is it? It's not representative.
It's not the world. No, it's not the world. So we needed to do something about that. So I did a whole project, a year-long project with Imaginate called Weren't You Expecting Me, where I looked at some of the reasons why that might be happening. Why is it that disabled performers don't go into work or into making work for children? And also made a really interesting realization that when I perform for adult audiences, I often at the end of it kind of get these responses from audience members sort of saying, "You're so amazing, that was just really inspiring." And when I make work for children and babies, I don't get that from parents. I just get their fascination with how engaged their children have been. So it's almost like it's not glossing over, but it's just their interest is in themselves and their babies rather than they're processing it in a different way, which I really love.
I kind of feel that to a certain extent we are trained to be freaked out by things, be that people of different colour, different sexuality, different ability, different, just looking different. And very small children don't have that inbuilt.
No, they don't at all. And that was the other thing I became really interested in, is when does that prejudice start? Like when does that freakiness begin for kids? Because actually most kids I interact with are just fascinated. They have a question and then I answer their question and then we go on to the next thing. So if their question is, why are you so little? And I give them a response and then they're like, do you know my dad snores, or I've got new shoes on, or whatever, and we're on to the next thing. We're not hanging in there with that. We've just, I've got a question, I'm going to ask it, and so we move on. And, yeah, I just think as adults we don't do that.
Well, maybe we're also worried to ask questions as adults, because it's a sense of like, ooh, I don't know if I should mention that, or if I should offer to help, or if I should say, oh, I've never met someone of that religion before, and do you eat this, you know, and people are just don't want to offend, and in doing so maybe a little bit too standoffish or look freaked out.
Yeah, I think there is this thing that always interests me about when you add a visible difference, because we know that 94% of the disabled population has some form of invisible disability. So we are living amongst disabled people all the time. We just can't see it. But when we have a visible difference, then that becomes a thing about all of a sudden we just kind of go, oh, I don't know what to do about that. But we expect ourselves to know, which I also think is tricky. But I have a theory when I do disability equality training with people, I always say, think about the question, is it a want to know or a need to know question? So your brilliant example about, I've never met anyone of that religion before, can you eat this? If you're the caterer or a function manager or organising a conference or whatever, you need to know people's dietary requirements. Or if you're having mates over for dinner, you need to know their dietary requirements. But if you're just a punter in the street, you don't need to know that information.
Yeah.
So if you're a tailor, for me, and I'm so short, if you're a tailor or you're a doctor or a whatever, the information that you need from me is very different to just someone who might be curious in the street. So it's tricky. It's really tricky. But I also think in that trickiness, we get stuck in this place. We just can't even have a conversation, which is also dodgy.
So starting with children and starting with that, opening their minds to it, is the way of making a difference. One audience, one show at a time, is it?
I think so. And I think because I think the thing that we need to do is we need to normalise disability. The reason that we're uncomfortable with it is because it's not familiar to us. And so the more we can widen our social circles to include all sorts of people, the more comfortable we'll become with each other, then we'll realise what a big thing it's not, actually, and that we're all just human and we're all different from each other and we've all got our quirks. Just need to get more familiar with it.
Yeah, and we have had there a serious discussion about attitudes to disability, but actually Sniggle and Friends is a giggle, if potentially. So can you say goodbye to me and Sniggle, please? Caroline Bowditch and Sniggles, thank you very much for talking to me.
I talk sniggle. Honestly, I love speaking to Caroline. That was Caroline Bowditch. Yeah, the performance and the performer and choreographer, one of the performers, in fact, and choreographer of Sniggle and Friends, talking to me on Skype earlier. Bye bye. Yeah, it was fantastic. Sniggle and Friends, which looks just great for those of you with a babe in arms, will be, and they'll be entertaining the under ones at the Dome Founders Room this Friday through Sunday, and challenging our preconceptions of what performers should look like as well. Performances 11 a.m., 1 p.m. and 3:15 p.m. Do check the Brighton Festival website for more details on that and for tickets.
The Brighton Festival 2018. Radio Reverb, the only station on air with a dedicated Brighton Festival hour.
And new flavours of tango, that's the dance, not the tooth-rotting drink, are coming tonight to the All Saints Church in Hove. Tango Motan are an international quartet based in France who each bring their own backgrounds to the music to create a sound that is uniquely theirs. I went to All Saints Church just as they were arriving.
Hello, I'm Blanche Stromboni. I play double bass and I'm from Corsica.
I'm Marion Chiron. I play the bandoneon and I'm from France, but I'm actually studying in Finland.
Hi, I'm Leandro Lacaper. I'm from France and Argentina and I play piano.
Hi, I'm David Harutunyan. I was born in Armenia and I'm living in Paris now.
You're based in France, but you are an international troupe. Tango, obviously, is Argentinian. What do you bring of the flavours of your own country to tango that makes it different?
Leandro is half Argentinian, so he's actually the one who was born in tango. For myself, I just fell in love with this music and with this country when I went there a few years ago now.
We come from different backgrounds, like musical backgrounds, and our education, our instruction, it's also the way we approach tango, it's quite different from one another here in the group. So it makes it interesting also.
So you will have grown up listening to traditional tango.
Yeah. Well, the difference is we could just restitute the traditional music of the tango, but now we think it's important to give nowadays society and nowadays resounds for the new music tango. So when we play traditional music, we try to adapt it for our time. And when we do new composition, we are trying to take the inspiration from nowadays society and all the things that around us. We have a lot of things to describe as the tango music described the Argentine 19th century and 20th century. So for us, it's a way to describe our time society.
So who is classically trained here? Three of you, okay. So tell me, you were classically trained, but have you had to almost unlearn of your classical
that's
training?
Exactly the point that it, you know, the very clean and very professional way to learn the classical music. Actually, for playing this music, we had to just abandon all these sensations and all what exactly as you told it, to unlearn the proper way to play and to just try to understand how the way the people were playing, the people that almost were not actually playing that well for a lot of them from the beginning of the 20th century but it was so beautiful. So how we say the stallion of the music are not the same actually.
You're all very young. Do you think you're going to bring tango music to a younger audience because of your passion for the music and the way you play it?
The thing is that the music is not for one audience or one age. Of course, it's for nostalgic people because it's coming from Argentina that they have this nostalgia of Europe. But the purpose of our music is just to bring to everyone who loves music and who feels like it's just very emotional music, so it can be exactly the same goal than for any music.
This is something we experienced among different concerts. It's that the vertigos of the tango music and our music talk to everyone, every age, every country they come from, and this is something universal.
You just walked into All Saints Church in Hove with its high ceiling. It's a big Gothic church. What did you think when you walked in and you saw, wow, we're playing here tonight?
It's a very different kind of idea that I had about, like, when I was imagining coming here and playing this music. I hope we will play great.
It's very beautiful, so you cannot see it on the radio, so just come and see us tonight.
it's also our purpose to mix between the tradition and the newest thing we can put in music. So to play in the church, in the old church, old monumental Gothic church, it's nearest our project also.
We'll be delighted to come back for a longer while.
It seems really nice city, like the weather is perfect these days. So
yeah, English weather, back. Always good.
Yeah. Okay, yeah, sure.
Yeah, well, it was good when I spoke to them at All Saints Church this afternoon.
Yeah, yeah, say that tomorrow morning. I think we might have rain then.
Well, anyway, lovely to meet Tango Motan. You can see them playing tonight. Don't forget to check the Brighton Festival website, brightonfestival.org, for last-minute ticket returns for any festival event. Also their Twitter, which is @BrightFest. So Tango Motan tonight, All Saints Church in Hove at 7:30.
You've been listening to the Brighton Festival special show with Melita Dennett and Rebecca Sandals here on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, DAB and online. We're live Monday to Friday, 5 to 6pm during the Brighton Festival, repeated at 10pm and 9am the next day.
And thank you to today's guests, Kathy Tyson and the Heath Quartet, Tango Motan, Caroline Bowditch, Tom Adams and Lillian Henley. From me and Rebecca, we'll see you tomorrow.